Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. The story of Violette Nozier is shocking, a scandalous affair. And yet, as Sarah Mazza points out in her excellent new biography entitled Violette Nozier, A Story of Murder in 1930s Paris, through this story, there is much to be learned about the lives of middle and working class Parisians in the 20s and 30s, lives that are so often overshadowed by the two world wars. Today I'm talking with Sarah about Violette Nozier and her new book, which is now out in paperback. Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books in Biography. I wonder if you could just kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yes. Well, I'm a historian of France. I have taught at Northwestern University for about 30 years. And I have very deep connections with France because I actually grew up there. My parents were expatriates. My dad ran a school for American students in the south of France in Aix-en-Provence, and we moved there when I was five, and I did most of my schooling there. I went to kindergarten, elementary school, middle school, lycée, and even did my undergraduate degree there, and then I moved to the States. And actually, all of my family, who are Americans, still live in France, so I have this funny bicultural background. And professionally, I started out as a historian of 18th century France, so I worked on the period before the French Revolution, and I did one book that straddled the period of the French Revolution into the 19th century. And then after I'd been in that subject for a while, in that chronological frame for a while, I decided that I needed to a little bit of a change, and I started working on the interwar period. So that's the background to the book. I teach at Northwestern. I teach quite a bit of different things, but my core teaching is in the history of France from the 18th century to the present. And I'm somebody who's interested, as the book sort of suggests, in issues of society and culture and ideas.
So how did you come across the story of Violette?
I came across her story in the most straightforward way. The way this book came about was that I had a very vague set of questions that I started out researching. I went to Paris for a year. I had been chair of my department for 3 years, and as a reward for good behavior, I got a sabbatical. And fortunately, my family was able to come. And so I went over to Paris, and I was thinking, well, I would work on crime in the interwar period. It just seemed to me that there is this all of this aura of kind of darkness and anxiety and this kind of noir feel about the period. And I thought, okay, well, I've always been interested in crime, so I'm going to, in crimes in history and what they can tell us about societies. So I started reading broadly, and I knew there were a few salient crimes, but actually back in the States, I'd heard the name of Violette Nozier, and I hadn't been able to find a book here at Northwestern's library. So I just waited. I figured it could wait. And I had been in Paris a few weeks and was at the National Library, and I called up this book that was written in the 1970s by a man named Jean-Marie Fitter, which was simply a straightforward account of the case. And I remember spending, you know, the better part of a day completely sucked into this book, to this story that Fitter told. It was a book of popular history. There was no footnotes. It was very frustrating. There were no indication of the sources he'd used, although I could tell he'd used some pretty serious sources. I could tell it was well researched, but with absolutely no footnotes, no bibliography, nothing. And I also knew that this book had served as the basis for a movie made by the filmmaker Claude Chabrol, who was part of the French New Wave in the 60s and 70s. So that book, the Fiter book, the one I read, was published in 1975. And so this was, you know, 30 years later, there I was in Paris reading this book, which was the only book about this case that I had been able to find. And it appeared from the book that this case had been huge, that people were really completely fascinated. In fact, the name was one that I had often heard. And I remember coming back that afternoon back home and to our apartment in Paris and talking to my husband and saying, wow, I just read this story. It's amazing. And I told him the whole story from beginning to end. And he looked at me and he said, it sounds like you're going to write a book about this case. And I said, yeah, I think so. And so that it came about in the stupidest way. I said, there's only this book. It's you know, it's good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go into the context, and it's not written by a scholar, and there's been nothing since in 30 years. And so that's how I got into it. It was very straightforward.
Oh, I love it. So, go ahead.
Some of the more general questions, of course, I had about crime and the particular forms of crime reporting in the 1920s and 30s found their way into a chapter of the book. So that broader context about crime is there in some form, but it really was, you know, was so much more fun to hang the whole inquiry about crime around this one story.
So, right. Yeah. So what sources were particularly useful to you? Obviously, there wasn't that the book was good for getting the story, but if it didn't have footnotes, it would be difficult to track down all the information. How did you go about doing that?
The information? Well, the first thing I found out was that, there was a huge amount of reporting in the press. So that wasn't difficult. I was already working in the National Library in Paris, and could call up all these newspapers, and I knew when the case had happened. There were a lot of newspapers, so it took a long time, and there was intense reporting over several months, and then a hiatus, and then intense reporting around the time of the trial. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge amount of newspaper coverage, but of course that did not give me direct access to the crime. It was mediated through the press. But what was particularly wonderful about the crime was the case records. And the case records turned out to be difficult to get access to. As somebody who had worked on the 18th century, where, you know, you can look at anything, nobody, you know, any sources that you can find are fair game. And I quickly discovered that in France there is a 100-year embargo on any kind of criminal records, and you have to ask for a special dispensation to look at anything that is less than 100 years old. And of course, you know, it was 2005 and my story had happened in 1933, so you have to ask for something called a dérogation. And I held my breath for several weeks while waiting for this dérogation, which I got. So I was very happy about that. But actually, that was the set of records in the archives, the police archives of the city of Paris, the Assizes Court archives. But the police archives also existed. There was a separate archive that had the police records. And that one I wasn't granted access to. It was very frustrating. I was there in the director of the archives in her office, and she was sitting there with this big file on her desk, and she said, well, we've just made the decision that because there are descendants, blah, blah, you can't have access. And I'm staring at this file and going crazy. the end of that, thinking, can I just grab it and run, maybe, you know. But the thing that, actually what happened was that subsequently the law was revised down to 75 years, so I got to see the police records several years later, and they turned out to be duplications of a lot of what I'd already seen. So Turns out that my frustration was misplaced. But anyway, the police records in this case are amazing. They are extremely abundant, and that was, you know, the I think I would have worked on it anyway, but the police records were the clincher because, as you know, if you've read the book, there is everything from detailed descriptions and photos of the crime scene, of the apartment where these people lived, of there are inquiries, there are, you know, the transcripts of interviews with every single character in the case, sometimes more than once. There are detailed narratives of what happened by Violette and by her mother. And best of all, the most amazing thing that's in the records are the dozens and dozens of letters that were written by people all over France to the judge who was in charge of the case, telling him what they thought. So there's this extraordinary record of contemporary public opinion about the case that I was able to use in one of my chapters. Like, I think the most moving thing was the letters that are in the case from women who had been sexually abused as children. That's part of the case, of course. Who wrote to the judge basically telling their stories and saying, you've got to believe her because listen to what happened to me. And just holding those letters, there was one that was written by a peasant woman on basically on wrapping paper in pencil, barely grammatical, I mean sort of phonetic spelling, telling the story of what happened to her as a child. So it was obviously this was a case that touched a nerve for a lot of people, and the letters in the court case are kind of testimony to that.
So people who don't know what the crime is are probably dying to know what it is right now. But first, I have one more question, because one of the many things that I found fascinating in the book was how really early on you make the distinction between a scandal and an affair. Can you explain to listeners what the difference in those two terms is and how that plays into this story?
Oh, yes. This distinction was something I picked up from a very interesting book by a group of French sociologists and anthropologists called, the translation would be Affairs, Scandals, and Great Cases. And what they say, drawing on a lot of anthropological literature, their definition is that a scandal is an event that happens in a society and that unites the society. And that causes people to sort of pull together and assert their common values, so that something that is perfectly heinous, you know, I think of, say, Bernie Madoff. That's a scandal because when what he did came to light, it was obvious that there weren't two sides to the story. He was a terrible person, and it was enlightening what happened, what he did, and its consequences were enlightening, but they were an occasion, basically, anthropologists would say, for a society to articulate its values. Many of the cases, the great cases that are prominent in people's minds, are what the French call affaire, an affair. And those are cases that occur, they say, usually in more developed, more stable societies where there is a stable polity and a well-developed public media. And what happens is that in their model, an affair begins as a scandal. Somebody seems to be a villain and to have done something wrong, but then somebody emerges as that person's defender and turns the tables and shows that there is another side, and that, in fact, the person who was supposedly the villain is, in fact, the victim. And then the affair becomes something that divides a society. So the paradigmatic case there would be the Dreyfus case, where Captain Alfred Dreyfus, in 1894, I think it was arrested and convicted of being a traitor, condemned, sentenced to hard labor on Devil's Island, and everybody thought he was you know, the Bernie Madoff of the day, but then a group of defenders, including prominently Emile Zola, step up and say, no, in fact, he's wrongly accused and he's been framed and there have been cover-ups, and then another side appears. And the most tragic of these affairs are the ones in which, you know, you have basically two sides and each side has its own logic. So in the Dreyfus case, of course, all of us today think, well, you know, we would be on the side of Captain Alfred Dreyfus, you know, the Jewish innocent guy who was framed. But, you know, the people who were accusing him thought they were defending France and the honor of their country and the honor of the army. And so these incompatible moral imperatives clash in an affair. And the other paradigmatic affair that I mention in the book is O.J. Simpson, because you, on the one hand, you have people for whom he is the villain who's perpetrated, you know, domestic violence and then domestic murder. On the other hand, on the other side, you have people for whom he is the victim of racism and a frame-up and so on. So that's the distinction that these scholars make, the scandal that unites a society versus the affair that divides a society and that more painfully allows for debate and discussion. And it's not a unifying thing like a scandal. And then the argument I make about this case is that actually what's interesting about this case is that it wasn't really either one of those. It had elements of both a scandal and an affair, but it never settled into being one of those, and that was what is complicated and interesting about it.
So let's talk about Violette a little bit. Can you tell us about her childhood and her relationship with her parents?
Yes, she was a very ordinary little girl. I mean, the thing that is interesting about this case is that, and I think the reason why it had so much resonance is that what happened in the most ordinary family you could imagine. The family in question, there was a three-person family, very small nuclear family. Violette Nozière, who is the protagonist, who is the daughter of a couple named Baptiste and Germaine Nozière, who lived in a very nice working-class neighborhood, not a poor or dangerous, but sort of kind of lower-middle-class, respectable neighborhood on the very eastern end of Paris, so part of Paris that most tourists nowadays never go to. I mean, it's a very ordinary Paris neighborhood. And she was the daughter of a lower middle class, upper working class family who were well off for people of their sort. Her father was an engine driver, and that was a very good job. He was as a worker, he was privileged, in the sense that engine drivers for the railways had more stable jobs and made more money than other kinds of workers. And her mother was a housewife, stayed at home, which again was unusual at the time. Most women in the working classes went out to work. So she was both, Violette was both from a very modest, very poor background, but at the same time she was privileged compared to other workers, and she was an only child. So I make a lot in the book out of this kind of social ambiguity of the family. That is, they weren't really poor and they weren't really rich, so a lot of people could impose meaning on the family, could project whatever they wanted, and that's why so many stories and so many framings happened, because this family was neither here nor there socially. So she was very privileged and spoiled. Her parents doted on her. A lot of people at this time in France had a single child. It was very, very common. That was one of the first things I learned. I was talking to a friend who knew more about this period than I did when I started the project, And I said they had one child, and my friend, who's a historian working on this period for a long time, she said, oh, that's completely typical. That kind of family between the wars and the French in general had very small families, and often only children, often a single child, because it was a strategy for upward mobility. You could then ensure that that only child, or the, maybe your two children, could have an excellent education and rise in the world. So she was the little girl who was going to do well and continue the family's rise out of the working classes. I should add that Violette's parents, you know, they were lower middle class, upper working class, but they came from very poor backgrounds. I mean, that's their story, again, is typical of their time. They both came from different areas in the French provinces, and her father came from an area in central France that was practically wild. I mean, people who, you know, a very, very poor peasantry, people who believed in witchcraft and didn't speak French and often starved through the winter. I mean, he came really from the back of beyond, and so becoming an engine driver was a first big jump in social mobility. And clearly that's where the family was headed. They were going to, with their child in whom they invested everything, they were going to keep on climbing up the French social ladder. And so they gave her, they pushed her educationally. She went to primary school, then she went to what was called upper primary school, which is where you would stop your education usually at, in her social class. So she went to primary school till she was about 10, and then upper primary school for 3 years, and then she should have gone out into the workforce after that, because upper primary school gave you the skills to become a saleswoman or a secretary, whatever. And her parents decided, no, they were going to enroll her in secondary school. They were going to send her to the lycée, which is high school. And that was unusual. That was children of her social class did not go to secondary school. That was for the upper middle class. That was for what was called at the time the bourgeoisie, the children of the elite. So you already have a family that is going through a fairly drastic and abnormal process of social climbing, and that becomes central to the case.
You write that parents with girls to raise are usually concerned with formal education and sexual safety and propriety, and that those two things are always linked. What were the norms regarding this during Violette's time, and how did she conform to them or rebel against them?
Ah, well, that's interesting. There were some differences. I did quite a bit of work on trying to reconstruct what the patterns of sexual behavior were for girls at the time. And, norms of behavior were very strict in the upper classes and the upper middle classes. So, you know, we have a wonderful document about this that I used very heavily, because it's something that it's both a wonderfully written and something that people recognize, which is the memoirs of Simone de Beauvoir, the first volume of her multi-volume autobiography, which is called Memoirs of a Dutiful Daughter, is an extraordinary document about how strictly controlled girls were in the upper middle classes and upper classes. So someone in Simone de Beauvoir's class, she never went out of the house on her own until she was 18 years old. She lived in the center of Paris, but she could not leave the house, leave the small apartment they lived in, because they were upper class but not rich. She could not leave the apartment without somebody going with her, her mother or the family maid or someone else, another adult. And, for instance, in that social class, girls, until they got married, their mothers would always open and read their letters, both going in and going out. So if you wrote a letter to somebody, your mother would read it before sending it out, and so on. So you have these very strict norms in the upper classes, which is extraordinary because, you know, you think it's the 20th century and you don't really, I think people don't quite realize how archaic it was. And it's still a time when, again, in Simone de Beauvoir's environment, girls couldn't get married unless they had a dowry. You had to have money to, you know, put into the marriage, and marriages were still semi-arranged. You couldn't get married without parents vetting the fiancé, making sure he was from a good family, and so on. So you have that model. But then I discovered, somewhat to my surprise, that there were differences, but the same. There was a similar kind of pattern in the lower middle class and the respectable working classes, which was that girls were not supposed to have boyfriends until they really officially got engaged. And so I found autobiographies of several women from the working classes, and you could not have a boyfriend if you were under 18 or you weren't engaged to the boy. So the norm was you don't run around, you don't go out with boys until you're of age to get married. And that is exactly what, and so Violette transgressed this norm. She started going out with boys, you know, having boyfriends, and in fact, having sexual relations very quickly when she was about 15 or 16 years old. And this was quite shocking to people in her environment. There's a lot of testimony in the case record that people in the neighborhood knew about this. They were scandalized. Her parents found out about some of her boyfriends, and there were big, big scenes at home. And in fact, when the last family crisis before the murder actually happened, before the crime actually happened, involved their discovering letters from this young man she was seeing, and, you know, they start yelling and screaming at her and saying, who is this boy and what does he want, and you're going to write him a letter saying that he has to get in touch with your parents. So there's a lot of formality and very high standards of behavior in the working classes, too. And Violette was somebody who completely flouted these norms by going out with boys and having, as we know from the case, she actually started sleeping with boys when she was about 16 or 17 years old, which in her environment was totally scandalous. And as we'll see, there is a reason probably why she was doing that. Mm-hmm.
I think this kind of plays into that and also heightens the drama of their family melodrama as well, was that they were living in extremely close quarters, right? Their apartment was quite small.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why people had small families in Paris at this time, was there was a very severe housing shortage. There had been a big population increase in Paris. Well, people were constantly immigrating, as the Nozières themselves had done, and rents were kept artificially low between there were rents stabilized during the war, so there was no incentive to build more housing because it was just landlords couldn't make much money from the rents, and so the housing stock was too small for the population. Everybody grew up in tiny apartments. Well, you know, if you go to Paris today, people still have tiny apartments. Nowadays people will make an apartment out of breaking through a wall and conjoining two apartments. It's quite an obsession in Paris, as it is in New York. But the Nozières, again, were considered privileged because they had more space than most people. They had exactly two smallish rooms for the three of them. So Violette did not have her own bedroom. The parents had a bedroom, the double bed, and then very close to the bedroom was the living/dining room in which there was a folding cot, and every night they unfolded the cot and Violette slept in the dining room, and then they folded it back up And in between the dining room and the room, there was a tiny, very shabby kitchen. It's more in the nature of a little hallway-type kitchen. And they did not have a bathroom, but they had a toilet, and that was unusual. That was a luxury, having your own toilet as opposed to a communal toilet in the hall was considered something desirable and fairly rare. And so, like everybody else, they at the time in Paris, I mean, again, I read as many souvenirs and memoirs as I could, and everybody talks about, even Simone de Beauvoir's family, about, you know, all these collapsing beds and screens that people put up for privacy, that, you know, the notion that each person would have a separate room was completely unknown. So it did make for a kind of hothouse atmosphere. Again, it's very interesting because you have Simone de Beauvoir's memoirs in which she complains bitterly about the lack of privacy, the fact that she could not find some place, because even though her family was upper class, they had the same housing problem. And there was no place where she could have any privacy and read and daydream and, you know, escape her mother. She's completely trapped. And the same thing for the Nozières. You know, when things went wrong in the family, there was just no place you could go. And nowadays, of course, in Paris, you have small apartments, and if you're getting on each other's nerves, you can just go out to a cafe. But back then, of course, since girls were not allowed out without parental supervision, they were trapped. You know, you would have a fight with your parents, and there you were in these two tiny rooms with nowhere to go because you weren't allowed to go out. So a lot of their physical surroundings, which again are depicted very, we have photos, so we have a sense of this apartment from the crime records. So that environment contributed, I'm sure, to what happened, to the family dynamic and to what happened.
So can you walk us through her crime a little bit?
Yes. Well, what happened was that, maybe I should talk a little bit before that about her fantasy life.
Of course.
Because that feeds into the crime. So I mentioned that Violette was having problems with her parents because she was... you know, she was known to have boyfriends. She was also failing at school, so they enrolled her in this fancy school, and she was cutting classes. And she cut classes to hang out with students. The fancy lycée they sent her to was in the Latin Quarter in the center of Paris, where, of course, a lot of students hung out, and was center of student life in Paris. And she was supposed to be going to school, but in fact she would not go to school, and she started making friends with young students in the cafes in the Latin Quarter. And of course, the young men who went to university were mostly upper class because, you know, if secondary school was exclusive, you can imagine that university was even more exclusive. These were all the children of the elite. And so she developed a fantasy life in which a set of lies about herself, where she told people she met in the center of Paris that she was the daughter of an engineer. Her father was an engineer for the railways, and her mother was a fashion designer working for a leading fashion house in Paris. And what's interesting is that these lies were rooted in reality. So she took her father's position as an engine driver and made him instead, you know, one of the bosses in the railways. And her mother used to sew clothes for her, and she transformed that into, my mother is a top designer for fashion house. And so she passed herself off as an upper-class girl. And she, in fact, was able to play the part because she was able to, this was the first generation in which somebody from a modest background could pass as being upper class because it's the first generation in Paris of people who have access to ready-to-wear clothes and off-the-rack clothes and to the department stores like the Galerie Lafayette and the Printemps, the big Paris department stores. So I'm emphasizing this because there's a way in which she was wishing her parents away before she acted on it. So she was, on the one hand, she was fantasizing about being somebody different, about being of a different social class. And in fact, she was acting out her parents' fantasies because they were the ones who had been pushing her educationally. And even though she'd rebelled against the education, she'd still somehow absorbed their dreams of social mobility. And she also, at the time, so this is after a series of conflicts and fights with her parents, she was at a stage in her life where she met a young man whose name was Jean Dabin, who was a law student, and fell in love with him. And somehow this triggered, I think, a desire to be rid of her parents. That somehow feeling that she had this connection with this young man impelled her to act on it. So her crime is, it's both not sensational in the sense that it's not a big, bloody, violent mess, but it is quite startling. So she, one day, after the umpteenth fight with her parents, goes to a pharmacy in Paris and purchases several tubes of a very powerful barbiturate that you could get over the counter and that was used as a kind of a sleeping pills, as a sleep medication. And she made up three different little packages with different markings on them. And she went home, so this is in late August of 1933, August 21st of 1933, a very hot day in late summer when a lot of people are on vacation in Paris. In fact, her boyfriend's away on vacation. And she was the person, she was being treated for various illnesses, among them, in fact, syphilis, allegedly, possibly syphilis. So she had been in touch with this doctor, who was a very upper-class doctor who her parents hadn't really met but were intimidated by because he was an upper-class man. So Violette forged a letter, actually, from this doctor to her parents, saying that because they had suffered various ailments, he was recommending this medication for them, and that he had entrusted it to Violette, and they should take this medication. So she actually sat down at the family dining table with her parents and told them each, gave them each a packet of powder, showed them the letter from the doctor, and said, I'm going to mix this powder into this glass of water, and now, Mom and Dad, would you please drink up? And they drank, and they both collapsed. Her father first collapsed on the folding cot that was her bed in the dining room where they'd been sitting. And her mother then dragged herself into the bedroom and onto the bed and fell unconscious. And Violette waited in the apartment. God knows what she must have been thinking. And she waited a couple of hours, then she took the money she found in the apartment, and she crept down the stairs of the apartment building. They lived on the top floor, on the sixth floor, and wandered around Paris for most of the night, booked herself into a hotel, and then the next day she woke up in this hotel in Paris, in the Latin Quarter, which she knew quite well, and sent a telegram home saying, Mom and Dad, I won't be home for dinner. I'll be back late, so don't wait for me. Sends this telegram. And then she spent the day basically shopping and partying. She went to the Galerie Lafayette. She bought herself a whole new set of glamorous clothes, some evening clothes. She came back to the hotel. She changed. She had contacted her best friend, a young woman named Madeleine de Bise, and they went out and hung around in a cafe and met some young men and went drinking with these young men. And one of the young men offered Violette a ride home. So she got home. So this was then the next night and then early the following morning of the next night. So it was about 1 a.m. And she crept upstairs. She went into the apartment, saw these unconscious bodies of her parents. She had left them unconscious. She found them both sprawled out. And she turned on the gas main in the kitchen and went and stood in the hallway. And after there was a powerful smell, she hammered on the door of the next door neighbor and screamed and said, "Come and see, please come and help me. I think my parents have committed suicide." And so the neighbors and then the police arrived to find the bodies of both of her parents. So that's the beginning of the crime. That's what happened. So why? Mm-hmm. Why had she done this, right?
Yeah, exactly. That was my next question.
So why had she done this? Well, everybody thought they knew why she'd done this, which was that her parents, being a kind of model family, pursuing a absolutely model path of upward social mobility, and, you know, they lived very modestly. They never spent money. So they had savings. They had considerable savings for people of their class. You know, in today's money, they might have saved something like $100,000, quite a bit. And so the story made sense to everybody. They said, okay, here is this girl. She is vain. She sleeps around. They called her vicious. She's vicieuse, which in fact meant sexually depraved. And so there's this narrative immediately of her as the total villain. It's a scandal. So that's why it starts as a scandal. She's Bernie Madoff. She's Dominique Strauss-Kahn. She's the person who, you know, you can't find an excuse for. She's vain. She's sexually dissolute. Her parents are model people. They have given her everything. They have sacrificed themselves. They are perfect. And what does she do in return? She poisons them. Why? Because she wants to, as the paper said, she wants to live her life. She wants to have fun. She wants to party. She wants to inherit their money, spend their money, and be the selfish, ungrateful villain that everybody is painting her as at the time. So everybody agrees that's why she did it. But then there's a bombshell. And the bombshell happens after a rather extraordinary episode in which Violette actually escaped the police. She just walked out. They weren't, you know, they were not watching her carefully. They never thought she'd have the nerve to do this. She just walked out into the street and disappeared into Paris and hid in plain sight for about a week. And they arrest her after there's been this kind of hunt for her throughout the city, and she's been staying with various former lovers and in hotels and so on. So everybody's in a frenzy of excitement. They finally, the police find her, they arrest her, and they bring her into the police station, and this actually rather compassionate police commissioner first starts interrogating her, and says, you know, why did you do it? Now, I should explain that she was in deep trouble for various reasons, including the fact that her father died, but her mother didn't die. Her mother survived. Her mother recovered, and of course, the first thing the mother did was to tell the police what had happened. That you know, what her daughter had done. She made no effort to conceal it. She was furious at her daughter. She was distraught. She said, then she explained exactly what had happened. So this police commissioner says, well, why did you do it? Why did you want to kill your parents? And Gillette reacts very vehemently and says, well, I didn't want to kill both of my parents. I gave my mother less. I just wanted to make her unconscious so she wouldn't intervene. I wanted to kill my father. He had been forcing me to have sex with him for the last 6 years since the age of 12. And that's why I did it. And she was completely straightforward, unwavering. She said, nobody helped me. I did this on my own. I wanted to do it because it was the only way I could get free of him. And this makes the newspapers the next day, and everybody is up in arms, you know, with initially everybody saying she has just compounded her crime. Not only did she kill her father, now she makes, as they say, this odious accusation. She is making things worse. She's just defending herself by murdering. She not only did she murder her father, she murdered the memory of her father. She's trying to murder the memory of a good man. So that was. So then you have her version versus everybody else's version, which is she did it for the money, and now she's lying. So that's the setup. So why did she really do it? That's, you know, what the book tries to figure out.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're running out of time, so everyone will just have to read the book to find out. It's such a good book. I really, really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for talking with us today about this. Any idea who you'll be writing about next?
I'm writing one general book that is an introduction to historical studies for students. So it's called Thinking About History. And then I'm going to continue working on this period, and I have another project called Rules of the Game that is a broader exploration of rules of sex and social class in Paris based on an extraordinary trove of autobiographies that I found that are kept in the center near Lyon. So I'm going to be exploring some of the same themes of sex and class, but in a much larger context through a much larger population. So those are my projects.
I've been talking today with Sarah Mazza about Violette Nozier, a story of murder in 1930s Paris, her new book, which is now out in paperback. I'm Online Eaton. This is New Books and Biography. Thanks for listening.